Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Welcome to another episode of the Self-Build Plus podcast, where we chat with self-builders, suppliers, and experts about all things home building and renovating in Ireland on both sides of the border. I'm Astrid Mattsson, your host and the editor of Self-Build magazine. This evening, I have the pleasure to be joined by architect Zeno Winkins of Winkins Architecture. So you're here to talk about spatial design, and you've been practicing in Ireland for a good few years now and specializing in low energy designs that are built in harmony with the environment, or the environment those buildings sit in. So I suppose the first question would definitely be then, your tips and advice about choosing the right location for your house on a greenfield site.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I've been in practice over 30 years in Wexford now, so it's been a while, yeah. So I think if you have a choice of sites, some people have a choice of sites because they're, you know, children of farmers and they like to build on the land. I always think it's good to approach the house that the road frontage should be facing north, because that way you can live in the south, you can live in the back. So the front is just the approach to the house, the entrance door and a few windows, you know, bedrooms and so on. But then you go through the house and then the back, that's where the terrace is, and you can live, you know, nicely on the southerly, southwesterly aspect. I think is nice to have a back garden or a back of a site. That's ideal. But you can work with anything, really.
Yeah. So let's say you're on you have your rooms, like your living room, your kitchen, that kind of thing. Like, is it always best to have your living room south facing? Is that kind of a decent rule of thumb, or?
I think so, because that's where you live. You know, most of the time is spent, you know, during the day or during the day of day-to-day life would be in the living room, in the kitchen, and, you know, so it's nice to have that south or southwesterly, because westerly is the evening sun, and a lot of people, you know, they work during the day, so when they come home in the evenings, they still have the enjoyment of the sun as well. So I think that's important.
So then bedrooms would be what, east facing for the morning sun? Would that be?
That would be ideal.
I mean, in an ideal world, if you can.
Yeah, like in an ideal world, again, yeah, you're right. Have eastern facing, so it'll wake you up in the morning to get you out to work. And then, and you know, because you want to live, as I said, on the south side. And the north side could be like bathrooms, utility rooms, and things like that. But sometimes it's hard to juggle like that.
Yeah, of course. And so in terms of doing that that analysis, it's a solar diagram of some sort, isn't it? How would you go about determining these axes on your plans? And would you always do?
I must say I use my gut feeling. I just use my experience. I know what works and what doesn't work. I don't use any software or anything for it. I usually, you know, walk. Yeah,
there's fancy
first.
Diagrams with suns and, you know.
I know. Well, I can do that too. I mean, when I do 3D modeling, I can actually, I have a thing for Wexford. So if I show a model, I can show, you know, what's going to be like the 1st of May at 10 o'clock in the morning, how the shadow's going to fall on the house. So I can do that. I can do shadow analysis as such. And that helps because it's amazing. And, you know, summertime is different than the wintertime, for instance, because the wintertime, the sun would be low in the sky. So that's when you want to get it into the house. And in the summertime, it's higher in the sky. And anyway, it's getting kind of hot. So to cut out overheating and so on, you take account of that as well.
Yeah, on that topic, because that's, I suppose we did have a very warm summer this year. So overheating is an issue in a lot of modern builds because there's so much glazing. So is the only solution really, is it just building sort of canopies sticking out of the house?
Well, might not be very first aesthetic. First of all, ventilation is an issue. Definitely, if you can, ventilate as good as you can when it's in the evening time to cool down the house again, if it is overheating. Because it may overheat, you might have too much solar gain in the summertime. But like this year, I think it was a week or two that it was terrible. I think in 17, 18, I think it was 5 weeks, which was a bit of a stretch, you know. But usually it's not that much of an issue. But if it is an issue, yeah, ventilation is the key.
So as in cross-ventilation?
Cross-ventilation is important. And trying to avoid that the heating, that the building heats up in the first place. So, you know, on a really strong summer's day, you draw the blinds or you draw the curtains, or if you have an overhang, of course, it's better. But that failing, just draw the curtains in the daytime to stop the solar gain, so that the building doesn't heat up in the first place. Because well-insulated buildings are designed to keep the heat. So if the heat doesn't come in the first place, it'll also stay cool. But with solar gain,
insulation works both ways. That's right.
And likewise, ventilation systems. That's another thing. With high insulation buildings and inner city and fist and so on, you do need some kind of mechanical ventilation. Really, I would really advise, even though you can still do it by regulations, I would advise against those holes in the wall because people just block the holes in the wall because they don't work in the wintertime, and then you have moisture problems and all sorts of problems. So some kind of ventilation system is good. With heat recovery, ideal, but even just a normal ventilation system is good.
Something that dedicated system.
Freshen the air all the time. It's not an air conditioning. It's the ventilation system for fresh air.
Mm-hmm. So then cross ventilation, we're looking at having windows and roof lights, isn't it? Because you need to design the windows in such a way that the cross ventilation can actually happen.
Sure.
How does that work? Like, do you always need a roof window that opens, kind of thing, isn't it? If you really want to purge all that heat out.
That's one way.
The ventilation system's not going to do that for you unless you have an active cooling or active something like the booster.
That's right. Yeah.
Ventilation
system will just keep your air fresh, but it won't cool down the house if it's overheating. And if it has heat recovery, yes, it will keep the heat in the wintertime, but it doesn't cool. You're right. And cross ventilation, true. It's front and back, so there's usually, especially in Ireland, there's usually some place somewhere where the wind is blowing, you know, either the east side, north side, you know. So if you just open windows, as many windows as you can in the house, and the wind will just flow through the house. That is good.
Roof lights, it'll happen.
Yeah, you don't have to have a roof light. Sometimes roof light, you know, I'm not too happy about it because it's difficult with air, getting the air tightness right with a roof light. So I try to avoid roof lights if I can, but we'll just have to keep an eye on how things are going with the old overheating.
Well, it's funny. In France, actually, they use shutters, as not to let the heat in. Because the blinds, I don't know if the blinds really work that well to close the blinds, because once the heat is in the house, you're kind of stuck with the heat. I mean, the blinds then, okay, maybe they buffer a little bit, but.
They do. Let's put it this way: blinds are better than nothing. And ideally, yes, you would have shutters on the outside, or or an awning or something that you can pull out or something, or just have a broussolet or some kind of a roof overhang. In general, you know, if it's a 3-foot roof overhang, you'll still have enough summer in the wintertime because the sun is low. And in the summertime, it'll shade nicely, you know.
Okay. And window and door locations then, where should those go? Like, let's say doors, first of all, because the Irish have an obsession with having like many, many back doors.
Cost-wise, no doubt about it, size matters. I mean, if you watch television programs with grand designs and they have terrace doors that are like 6 meters wide and they're, I don't know how many folds, triple folding, bifolding, whatever, they all look fantastic, but I would not advise it in Ireland. First of all, they cost a fortune. It could cost 3, 4, 5 times as much as sliding doors would in a decent size of maybe only 3 meters or something, or 3.5 meters, which is still plenty of size, you know? So, I think size does matter. And location-wise, obviously, I'm a favor of having a proper front door that is used as a front door and a back door that is purely used as a back door. As in, the back door should only be for the people living in the house, and the front door should be for anybody coming into the house and the reception.
So just one back door then would be your...
Well, no, it depends. I mean,
depends on the flow of the house, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely, and how big the house is. I mean, obviously, okay, the back door I would usually classify as a door near the utility room, so where the washing would take place or the laundry, and then you can just take your stuff straight out the back door, or this could be a side door as well if it suits the site. But and that'll be to your washing line or something, you know, which is handy. And then other doors would be sliding doors, that could be in the living room or a kitchen or a dining room or all three, if it's a big house. I've even had, I put doors in bedrooms, you know, because people wanted to have access to the garden from the bedroom. So it really depends on the design.
So what kind of guiding principles are there to follow? Let's say, maybe, what do you think of things like feng shui, for example?
Again, I must say I'm more back to my gut feeling. Feng Shui, yes, I've looked into it, but it is really a philosophy that you have to buy into and study. And, you know, by natural instinct, with certain things I would not do that would be Feng Shui. But overall, I do, my philosophy would be form follows function, as in, I believe the function of the house and the layout of the house and how you live in the house is more important than the curb appeal, the windows out front towards the road and how lovely it looks. You know, I think it's more important to have a nice flow in the house that is, you know, functional. So you would
always design from the inside out then, would it?
I would think so. Of course I keep an eye on the outside. I mean, but first I do my layout and I get a feel for what's needed and the flow. And then I say, oh, my, that window doesn't look right. And then I can move things around to make the proportions of it looking good as well. But I wouldn't start off doing the elevation first and making it nice and symmetrical with all these windows and then doing the inside. You know, I always do the floor plan first.
Yeah. So how do you go about that process? It's obviously a conversation with the people who are going to live in the house, but how walk us through the steps of how the design evolves, how that flow gets created for the individual or the family.
It's the brief. I need to know as much as I can about the people who want the house. I need to know how they live. Do they socialize a lot? Do they have children? Do they want more children? Do they need a guest room? And if you want to future-proof it, you know, if, for instance, if it's two-story, you want to future-proof, you make sure you have a bedroom downstairs and a bathroom, because for the elderly relative or for yourself when you have elderly or something, it's good to have a bedroom and a bathroom downstairs. So it's really about, you know, what the people want, and if they don't have a brief, then I would try to establish a brief with them. You know, how many bedrooms do they want? Do they like open plan or not? And for instance, labels of rooms can change. You know, what's a bedroom today could be, you know, a study tomorrow, or the other way around. You know, like a playroom could become a study or a bedroom, you know, so, or a second sitting room. rooms as such can change over the lifetime of the building.
Yeah. So then the whole doing one story versus a story and a half versus two story, kind of pros and cons of each of those kind of layouts.
Again, it depends on the site. I prefer bungalows myself, I must admit, because I just like the living on a single floor. I think it's handy. It's quite cost effective too, because the roof for me is just a protection cover. So my airtightness layer is at ceiling level. So if from a airtightness point of view, it's just a box. But then the pitched roof on top is just outside. So I have the roof wind tight, but not airtight. So the insulation layer is up there. So I just like bungalows. Two story can get more difficult with airtightness and so on, because the rafters are in the walls and there's a lot of ceiling to be done. And 1.5 dormers can be tricky as well. I mean, anything's possible, but the preference, I have bungalows as a preference.
But then if you get to a certain size, doesn't it get more cost effective to go two story, let's say, to build?
I don't think so. I honestly don't think so. Because of the detailing, it depends how the design is. If it's on a bungalow, it doesn't have to be too meandering. You know, it depends on the floor area of the bungalow. If it's obviously the best would be a round house is the most cost effective. After that, a square house, then a rectangle. So the more you deviate from that, the more expensive it gets. Like with little nooks and crannies, or if you angle it, or if you have bay windows and things. I mean, of course, you can have some snazzy design. Like maybe I've done a few times where I just took the bungalow and just broke it one angle to suit the site layout and bring in the sun. But the simpler the floor plan is, the more cost effective and the cheaper it's going to be to build.
I'm surprised you said that round was cost effective, because, like, first of all, the blocks are square. If you build with block, obviously.
Oh yeah, no, but the round. See, the round has a less outside wall. Let's put it that way.
Okay.
So, and then after that would be a square, because you know you've got 40 lengths, and then it's the map. You know, the ratio of floor space to wall. That's where cost can come into it. So that's why I said round is the most cost effective. I mean, obviously, right. I did a round house once, but that was a straw bale house. But that's a whole different interview.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I do prefer block work, I must admit. And the way I design as well is that I keep block work dimensions in my mind. So I know that, for instance, two blocks would be 90 centimeters. So if you make a window two blocks wide, there's no cutting involved. So, in the rest of the wall. So I try to design block work dimensions. And I know it's on a 225 millimeters, so I already have that in my head all the time. I know that 1350, 1800, those are block work dimensions. So if the wall's that big, there's no cutting of the block. There's only one block to be cut every other way, but you don't have to cut little slivers or anything. So
that makes it easier, definitely. Yeah, and more cost effective, less waste. So then, in terms of the size of a house, what kind of would you follow? Again, thinking if there's, you know, if it's a family with only one or two kids, would you have square meters in mind for different?
Well, size matters. Yeah, I mean, I've done a good few houses now that 150 square meters, 160 square meters, three bedrooms, and they're fine houses. They're big enough, plenty big enough. You know.
Very big.
Yeah, no, but you know, I'm telling you, the way construction costs is going now, that's what we're all going to be able to afford in the future. You know, we should really think about size and do we need, you know, 2,000 square foot, 2,500, 3,000 square feet? Do we really need four bedrooms, five bedrooms, six bedrooms? You know, I don't think so.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Yeah.
The things as well, if you design it right, you can add like 2 bedrooms easily, or 1 or 2 bedrooms easily in 10 years' time when you need it, or when you feel like it, or when your budget allows again.
Yeah, because the design is everything, isn't it? Because if you maximize the space you actually have and don't waste it with corridors or God knows what else. Yeah.
Or a lot of people have, they have, a fourth or fifth bedroom that they never use and it end up being a junk room. It'll be cheaper to have a garage or a shed or something, for a junk room than a bedroom that is airtight, fully heated and so on and so on, fully ventilated.
Yeah, it is. It is something that's, I think the average is 300 square meters in the Republic anyway for kind of one-off houses.
The 300 sounds a lot.
It sounds huge, doesn't it? But I think, it's 280 or something.
Yeah, that's possible.
Something very close to 300, which I thought was surprising considering. But anyway, it is too big, regardless
because
of how big your
family is. Estate houses, houses in Dublin or estate homes in general in Cork and other cities, they could be as small as 1,100 square feet, 3 bedrooms, semi-detached. And people live in them, no problem. They might be lacking a little bit in storage, but it's doable, it's livable. And again, if it's good design, it's fine.
So in terms of the design, again, what kind of common pitfalls you might come across? Do people come to you with, another architect's plans and go, I'm not too happy with the way this is? Are there kind of things that mistakes people commonly make in terms of design?
Well, luckily, I don't get those kind of clients, I must say. Usually clients come to me, they might have a sketch themselves that they've been working on. I had one particular client, I'll never forget. She'd been working on this house design for maybe 1.5 to 2 years. And she really thought she had it sussed. She had everything she needed in that house. But I had a look at it. And in a few weeks later, I gave her another house design that was completely different. But I used her design as a brief. I know what she was trying to get at, but I knew it would not work. It wouldn't be livable in the end of the day. And luckily she saw it as well, after a bit of a disappointment, she realized that my design was better in the end. And that for the site that was in it, it suited the site better as well. A lot of people start thinking about house design without a site in mind. And you really have to have a site in mind to have a good design.
Yeah, you can't just plonk anything in the middle of a field kind of thing.
Not really, no, because are there views to be had, or even the other way around, are there views you want to avoid? Is there a neighbor you don't want to look at? or as I said, the orientation, you have to work with what you have on the site, no matter what it is. And there's ways, and you can get around sites that are challenged.
So how should people go about putting together their wish list then? What needs to go on that wish list exactly?
I think the wish list should have everything, pros and cons. Like, first of all, you put down what your needs are. I need 4 bedrooms, I need 3 bedrooms. I would like to have an ensuite or not. Because, again, I've had clients that insist on ensuites and said, how could you not have one? And I've had another client who said, I do not want an ensuite. I want a 4-bedroom house, no ensuites, 2 bathrooms. I hate ensuites. So it's a very personal thing. Walk-in wardrobes are very popular now, which is great. So those kind of things, that'll be part of the wish list, pros. And then cons, like I said, I hate this, I hate that. that should be in the wish list as well. You know, things that
you just stuff that irritates you where you live now.
I do not like open plan. I want to have a proper, you know, living room separate from my kitchen. You know? It's personal.
Yeah. So how should people go about choosing an architect? Because it is a bit of a shopping around exercise as well, isn't it? I mean, that expertise, obviously, you want to get that expertise, but also each architect has their own style, their own approach, their own personality. So
true.
How should people tackle that?
Yeah, it's difficult, I'd say. What I would do is, first of all, you know what you like and what you don't like. You know, when you pass a house, if you see a house being built and you really like it, try to find out who the architect is, make a note of that for future reference, or, talk to neighbors and friends who've been through the process. You know, they might have somebody they could recommend or that they hate or that they've heard of. And if that all fails, then after that, like everybody else, hit the internet and see if you can on the internet and look for architects in your area and see what kind of websites they have. And, are there any designs that you like? Is, the website in general, is appealing or not? Is there anything you like or, and then after that, I suppose you drop an email to an architect that you're thinking of approaching and get some kind of a conversation going. Just to see, if you want to work with this person for over a year or not,
Should there be a site visit? I know now with COVID and all that, it's a bit difficult, but would it be worth meeting with the architects you've kind of shortlisted on site, or is that just overkill?
Well, the thing
is, you're kind of bringing the process, you're making the process go further then, because then they're going to start thinking about designs and things. So
yeah, I'd say
at which point is it, like, are you hiring them or,
Yeah, it really depends on the architect as well. But usually the initial meeting, I'd say, would not be with a site visit. What I would do usually, I try to find out where the site is and I get most information as I can. And I do like a feasibility desktop study myself. So I would look at the planning in the area because I can do that online fairly easily. I go to Google Maps and drive up and down or walk up and down to get a feel for it. And based on that, I would have a chat with the client and just to see how their ideas are, and things, and if there's a match. Because I think it has to match both ways. If I find a client comes to me and I find I cannot help this client because we're on totally different wavelengths, I just have to pass it on, it's no point in taking on a commission that I won't be happy with, because I'll be never able to satisfy that client.
Yeah, it is a relationship at the end of the day. It's quite unique in the build process.
Yeah, and it's based on trust. You have to trust your architect, and I have to trust the client. When I talk to them, I have to trust that they're telling me the truth, because it's a very personal thing. It's a two-way street. Because the way I see it, I am going to be the buffer between the client and everything else, between the client and the builders and tradesmen. Like, I work on behalf of the client. I have to make sure that, I serve them well and that the builder serves them well. So I have to whip the builder into shape on behalf of my client. That's my job. That's the way I see it. Once I have a full commission from design right up to certificate of compliance moving in.
Yeah. So any other tips, advice in terms of spatial design that we haven't covered?
The BER itself.
That's right. The difference between A1, A2, A3.
Well, at this stage, since November 2019, all houses and all new dwellings that are built have to be an A2 house anyway. So it's quite a high standard. It's quite good, but that means that the running cost will be a lot less than, like a C house. The SEIA, they published something a while back. They were saying like a 200 square meter house, like a B3 would cost about 1500 or something a year to run. A B1 is 1200, A3 is 900, A2 would be 800. That step is kind of small. Then an A1 would be 400 to run. That's the same, same size of house, just different standards of insulation and air tightness and so on. So I would definitely, at design stage or just either before planning or definitely before building, get a preliminary BER done to see how the values are running, because the BER is a holistic thing of a house. It, between the air tightness, which is only determined actually when it's built, but the heating itself and things like that, the windows and the walls and the floor and the roof, all that can be determined, you know, as a paper study. And those value together, that will be your BER. The assessor will put all those values into a software and he can give you a preliminary BER. And if things need tweaking, you know, oh, you need more insulation in the walls, you need better insulation in the roof, then you can do that before you even start building or going for tender. You'll know that already.
Yeah. So what does it take to get to an A1? Like if from an A2, which would be your standard, let's say you have your, because it's fairly well insulated already on the A2. I mean, yeah. you're looking at fairly good U values. And
A lot of it is the windows, believe it or not. That's another thing I would definitely recommend looking out for, specifying windows. Make sure you can get the paperwork. When you're shopping for windows, they a lot of them say, oh, it's an A-rated window. That means nothing. You need to get the exact U value, and not just for the glass, but for the whole window. And only that can the BER assessor can use. So getting the windows right is quite important, because that can really affect the BER big time, especially if you have a lot of windows. So definitely hammer out, before you order windows, certification. Do they have all the certification that you need? Or your BER assessor will need to put in the values, because chasing it afterwards is nearly impossible. So that's one thing to look out for, I think.
And would you need to put in PV panels to get the A1 as well, in addition to all triple glazed windows?
Pretty much so, yeah. Okay, I think at this stage, a heat pump is a no-brainer. You would want a heat pump, an air-to-water heat pump. That's good for your renewable energy thing. And I put at least 3 or 4 kilowatts of PV array on the roof. That'll definitely get you to an A2 and most likely an A1 if the rest of the envelope is right.
Yeah, with the same level of insulation that is required in the regs at the moment and air tightness, yeah.
Yeah, and luckily luckily the PV arrays have come down a good bit in price, so they're not as bad as they used to be like 5 or 10 years ago. I mean, I did my first A1 house in 2011 or so, and the PV panels were quite expensive at that time. But we got an A1. I think I was the 9th A1 house in Ireland at the time.
It's funny to think it was that, you know, it was only a decade ago already.
Yeah. Still, even now, we're only like talking 50 or 60, you know, but A1s are still kind of hen's teeth.
Okay.
Yeah, like there's 800,000 BERs out now at this stage, but the actual A1 percentage is very, very low, you know. I'm even surprised A-rated in general is very low compared to the 800,000 that there are.
You would hope that would change now with the regs.
Yeah, because since 2011, I think, you need an A3 house. So since 2011, all houses should be A-rated, really. So if you buy a new house, and especially a state house or something, and say, oh, it's an A-rated house. That has to be by law since 2009 or whatever. Mm.
Yeah.
It's kind of crazy.
Yeah. That's brilliant. So is there anything else we didn't cover in terms of spatial design or things that you wanted to mention?
Just on the envelope itself, on cost and stuff and building efficiency, I like to use block work, you know, fair enough. Timber frame is great too, but block work. But I use a wide cavity, which means I have about 250 mil of a cavity. You can get standard wall ties for that from a company in Wicklow, so that's no problem. But with a 250 cavity or a 200 cavity, you avoid dry lining. I see a lot of new builds with the new regulations. They build 150 cavity, and then they dry line as well. Dry lining should be your last resort. I would only dry line a cottage because you have to, because there's nothing else you can do with an old cottage. But a new build should not be dry lined, I reckon.
Do you mean insulated plasterboard or?
Yeah, insulated plasterboard or even more so, you know, even maybe the timber stud insulation and then the plasterboard. Because again, with block work, your inner leaf is the thermal mass. If you dry line, you lose that thermal mass. You might as well have a timber frame house if you're dry lining a blockwork house. That's my opinion, and that's the way it works. So I'd say a wife cavity, and I would not use any kind of styrofoam or any kind of board insulation in the walls either, because if it's slightly crooked, slightly not fitted, there's thermal looping and it fails and it, forget it, I would advise a wide cavity wall and a bonded bead fill that's pumped in afterwards. So the block layer, all he has to do is put up the blocks, clean the wall ties as he goes along, and then he can go away. He doesn't have to worry about insulation. You know, the insulation can be put in after the windows are in and the walls are all sealed up. Then the bonded bead is pumped into the walls and it's really snug and it's 100% fill and it doesn't fail or sag or anything. And there's no thermal looping.
Yeah, I suppose. But isn't there an issue with just making sure it really is clean inside and that there's no bits of mortar that are stuck in and all that?
Sure. There's
also the challenges of making sure the cavity is nice and clean.
Yeah, and but absolutely.
It's better than the thermal looping, obviously. It's easier.
Cavities have to be clean any case. So
yes.
If the wall ties aren't clean and there's a bit of mortar on it, and then you stick a board on it and it's crooked, there's a big air gap. At least if the mortar is on a wall tie with a bonded bead fill, it's only that little bit of the little lump of mortar that's failing, not the whole board of a meter might be failing otherwise. So and also I've seen up to a certain height with the cavities, they can actually sweep the cavity so wide at 250. You can see it wiped down, you can get a broom in, and clean it out, believe it or not. I've seen builders do that before they get to a certain height in the building in the bungalow.
Yeah, that's the way to do it, I guess. Yeah.
Up to windowsill level, they can actually still retro clean it, after the fact. But it's a lot easier to clean. A block layer is happier to clean a bit of mortar off a tie than to clean it and fit a board. And then he has to, then on the next row, when they're doing the walls, they're becoming mortars on the board again. So they have to clean the boards as well. With bonded bead, there's no problems like that. If the bottom of the cavity, if there's a bit of mortar, that's okay. Because the whole wall, the rest of the wall is not failing.
It's interesting. Yeah, there's pros and cons.
That's my opinion over 30 years experience at this stage. I really see, and I think builders appreciate it too at times, because block layers, they usually get paid by the block. So they have to be, the faster they can go and the in and out, the better it is. So they don't want to insulate. And the slightest crookedness of a board, even the tongue and groove boards, they fail. And then the percentage 10, 20, 30, 40, 50% failure, in that wall because of gaps. And you can only find out when you're living in it afterwards, because who's going to look to the cavity all the time and make sure that the board's 100%.
Yeah, and then your energy bills are not the 400 euro you said, but
yeah, not predicted,
a lot more than that. Yeah.
Yeah, not the predicted bit.
Yeah. No, that's great. Well, listen, thanks so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate you asking me. Thank you very much. I appreciate being here. Thank you.
Join us next time for more tips and advice from experts and self-builders alike. And if you haven't already, subscribe to Self-Build Plus. It'll give you full access to the selfbuild.ie website, including the Self-Build Plus journey, which is your step-by-step guide to self-building and home improving. Your membership also gives you first access to all videos and podcasts, as well as access to our members-only Facebook group, which features regular Facebook Live events.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape.
And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel, a pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.